And we turn to pro football now and to Denver, where the Broncos introduced their new quarterback today.
I'll introduce the next quarterback of the Denver Broncos, Peyton Manning.
And there was the image all of Denver was waiting for. John Elway and Peyton Manning holding up an orange Broncos jersey with the number 18 on it. Manning sat out last season with a neck injury. His former team, the Indianapolis Colts, let him go rather than pay him a $28 million bonus. Manning's contract with the Broncos is reportedly worth $96 million over 5 years. Here's Kirk Siegler of member station KUNC.
John Elway was beaming at this afternoon's press conference at team headquarters. The Hall of Fame quarterback is currently the Broncos' VP of operations.
My goal is to make Peyton Manning the best quarterback that's ever played the game. And he's got that ability with the football that he's got left.
A few seconds later, after showing off the jersey, Manning took the podium.
I called John Elway Monday morning and let him know that I wanted to be a Denver Bronco. I am thrilled to be here. I'm looking forward to meeting my new teammates and doing everything I can to help this franchise win another Super Bowl.
Elway and the Broncos' courtship of Manning had been going on for weeks, but since news broke that a deal had been reached Monday, it's been hard to find someone in this city who isn't talking about it. Chris Kendrick was standing in line waiting for a cheesesteak at a kiosk downtown.
He's a once-in-a-lifetime quarterback. He's that good.
And like most everyone, Kendrick is quick to bring up this past season's hero, Tim Tebow.
Well, I think it actually gives the Denver Broncos a shot more than what they had before with Tebow, at least in the near term.
The city lives and dies by the Broncos, and over on the bustling 16th Street Mall, season ticket holder Jason Smith hopes Tebow will stick around and be an understudy to Peyton Manning.
Great drive, very enthusiastic, really brought the team up, a lot of camaraderie.
A lot of camaraderie, and fans like Smith are quick to point out that Tebow was instrumental in a string of late-season comebacks last season, albeit with the help of his defense. It all culminated in the Broncos making their first postseason appearance since 2006.
Touchdown, Broncos! Tebow, a touchdown pass to Thomas!
I was at that playoff game against the Pittsburgh Steelers, and leaving the stadium that cold January night, Tebow mania was at an all-time high.
Peyton Manning killed Tebow mania. And I wasn't sure anything could kill Tebow mania.
But here's the interesting thing, says Denver Post sports columnist Mark Kisla. Tebow actually deserves most of the credit for the Broncos luring Peyton Manning to Denver. After all, the Broncos, he says, were destined for another losing season before Tebow came off the bench.
Tebow made it possible for the Broncos to get Manning. So, if nothing else, Bronco fans owe Tebow thanks for that.
Back on the 16th Street Mall, Denver native and Broncos fan Danny Liverance is getting some sun during a break from her sales job. She's more than ready to give Tebow that thanks because she hasn't bought into the latest hoopla around Peyton Manning.
He's probably going to get hurt, re-injure his neck, and we're going to be out a lot of money. I think Denver is looking for the second coming of John Elway.
Elway himself was never fully on the Tebow bandwagon, and at today's press conference he wouldn't commit to what his future with the team may be, but it's clear Peyton Manning is the starting QB.
We just had to make a decision as an organization, myself, Coach Fox, you know, what would be the best opportunity for the Denver Broncos to be competitive for a world championship, and Peyton Manning was that.
When asked about Tebow today, Manning said he'd be happy to be his teammate, but would wish him well if other opportunities come up. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Siegler in Denver.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
As a 21-year-old in New Jersey, Kevin Smith decided he wanted to be a filmmaker. His sister gave him advice: don't say you want to be a filmmaker, just be one. He did. With hardly any money at all in movie terms, Kevin Smith made Clerks at a convenience store where he worked, about guys like him who'd rather talk about Star Wars than work.
What did you like better, Jedi or The Empire Strikes Back?
Empire.
Blasphemy.
Empire had the better ending. I mean, Luke gets his hand cut off, finds out Vader's his father. Han gets frozen and taken away by Boba Fett. It ends on such a down note. I mean, that's what life is, a series of down endings.
Kevin Smith has gone on to a quirky and distinguished career, including movies like Chasing Amy and Dogma. So it is of some note that the guy who just decided to be a filmmaker has now decided to stop being one. Mr. Smith tries to explain this in a new book whose title is as profane as some of his movies, a title that is actually bleeped on the cover, so which we cannot say it on the radio, except that the first of the two words in the title is tough. Mr. Smith, welcome to the program.
The second one, we could go with, you know, it's a good interjection for radio. Let's call it Tough Smith.
I like it. Tough Smith.
And most people, you know, my critics would tell you, like, those words are interchangeable.
Oh,
so
well,
it actually works out. It's weird. I was listening to the intro, and that's 20 years ago now. I'm 41, so it was 20 years ago that my sister was like, be a filmmaker, and I kind of went for it. But 20 years later, man, you will find no end of people who are like, well, we're still waiting for you to be a filmmaker.
Well, you know. I'm not one of them. I loved Clerks, and there have been many distinguished films since. A few that have been panned as well, but that's life. Why stop making movies?
You know, for me, it was never about, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I was 21. I saw Richard Linklater's film Slacker, and it moved me. I said, if this guy could tell stories about his people in Nowheresville, USA, which turned out to be Austin, Texas. A lot of people seem to know it. I didn't at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know it was the state capital of Texas either. But this guy made a movie on his own, and that inspired me. I said, this is what I want to do. You know, it's like I think so many of us, we get the golden ticket, and we're like, we're just going to do this until we go toes up off this planet.
But sure.
For me, it was like, I want to tell these stories. I'd see movies, comedies, and I loved Animal House. I loved all the John Hughes stuff. But I never saw me and my friends totally represented. Our wacky misadventures weren't nearly cinematic. You know, it wasn't like, we're taking on a dean. It was more like, we're going to sit around and talk about Star Wars for like way too many hours without booze or drugs. Like, that becomes the booze and drug. So I said, let me create that. And then I went out and made Clerks and stuff. And those movies now, throw a rock, you hit a movie like that.
But
know?
Let's talk about this. You're still a creative guy. You've gotten into podcasting in a big way. If people
mm-hmm.
don't know that, you're into other creative endeavors. You're still having to come up with ideas, come up
absolutely.
With thoughts.
Absolutely. But I get to take them into other arenas. I think about my father, as you know in the book, I talk about my father quite a bit. But my father didn't have the luxury of going, you know, at a certain point, 20 years into his career, I'm going to change horses midstream. He had one job.
That job
so,
was?
He worked at the U.S. Postal Service, and we were so proud of him because he never shot anybody. You know what I'm saying? One of the few postal clerks who ever made it through the system without going postal.
Now, come on.
Well, that was
one of the few. Come on.
All right, one of the many. But he hated the job. He absolutely hated it.
But you're saying that this was actually a fear you had.
Well, it wasn't so much a fear, but like I watched my father kind of wake up and not want to go to work, and I just said, I don't want to do that. I'll work, but that work's got to be something that I like. And with film, I did that for a while. And film is a slot machine if you find the right one. And boy, did we with Miramax and Clerks and Harvey Weinstein.
Well, let's talk about Harvey Weinstein. This is a guy who bought your first film, who guided mm-hmm. your career in many ways. You praise him in many ways, but you also seem to have had some difficult times with him.
The relationship I had with Harvey was definitely more like that father-son relationship that you read about in literature and whatnot. I love him to death, but yeah, I've definitely had some issues along
Oedipus,
the way.
That's what
yeah,
you're thinking here.
I guess. But does that mean I want to have sex with him? Because I don't want to have sex with Harvey.
I think it's killing your father. That would be the Oedipal.
Boy, I've had it wrong forever. You're really turning me around here, man. I don't know how I got this far confused.
Maybe now you've got an idea for a film you've got to go make before
yeah,
you're done.
Yeah, Hollywood, I'm back.
Well, what went wrong in that relationship with Harvey Weinstein?
It wasn't so much what went wrong. It's, you know what it was? I was an idealist. I was a young man, and I believed kind of everything I was told. And back in those days, we were told, like, this is indie war, man. We're taking on the studios. They're making commercial crap, and we're making art. But you know what happens is a good idea becomes a business. And suddenly there was a day where I was like, we're listening to marketing data that you're getting based on trailers, not even like test screening a movie. We're test screening trailers and poster images. There's no more gut instinct in this.
Well, there is the question of your brand. You write about Harvey Weinstein having a particular brand as a head of a studio and maybe damaging that brand over time. You, I think it's fair to say, have a particular brand as a filmmaker. People
yeah.
have some idea of the kind of film that you have made up to now.
Yeah.
Now you're in these other forms of entertainment and art. What do you think is the Kevin Smith brand?
I've been trying to figure that out, man. It's not filmmaking anymore. And, you know, you're not talking about the mainstream. You're talking about people who are kind of into the stuff I do, which is enough for me to build an entire career on. Like, that's what I figured out. I was just like, you know what, man, I've got this audience and they like the films, but they like when I do Q&As as well. They just like whatever I do. So the audience made me feel safe enough to step away from filmmaking. It's weird. You feel conflicted as an artist, right? Mm-hmm. You want an audience, but ideally, you don't want them to have to pay for what you do. You want to give it away, dude. That's where the podcasting came from. I was like, this is a way where you just give it away for free. And the podcasting, I swear to you, on its worst day, the podcasts are better than our best films because they're more imaginative and there's no artifice and it's far more real.
Do you worry at all that at some point in the future, after you stop making films, that you, well, that you kind of become like Kim Kardashian, just somebody who people, they know the name. They're not quite even sure why they know the name, just somebody famous.
You know, yeah, I guess there's the kind of Kim Kardashian version of that where you're just like, ugh, she's kind of known for being herself. But to be fair, one of the greatest reality shows like we ever watch in this country is about the president. He leads it every day, and we seem interested in that. So he's the opposite end of the spectrum. So I feel like I fall somewhere between the president and Kim Kardashian. And that's an okay place to be, man. It's a lot further than I ever thought I'd get as a fat kid, I'll tell you that much.
Kevin Smith's new book has a title we cannot quite say on the air, so let's euphemize it, as he suggests, as Tough Smith. The subtitle is Life Advice from a Fat, Lazy Slob Who Did Good. Mr. Smith, a pleasure to talk with you again.
Pleasure, sir.
All right, Kevin Smith is at work on what he says is his last movie, the hockey comedy Hit Somebody, which is due out next year. Then he's done. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
Today is the first day of spring. Where we are, that means longer days outside, getting out the garden tools, and the beginning of barbecue season. For Iranian Americans and others from the Middle East, Central, and South Asia, today is the beginning of a new year. In Persian, the holiday is called Nowruz, which literally means a new day. It's seen as a time of rebirth and renewal, and like most holidays, Nowruz is all about spending time with family and eating lots of great food. To get a sense of just some of the tasty dishes served for Nowruz, we decided to call upon Iranian-American chef and author Donya Bijan. Her memoir, Maman's Homesick Pie, came out last fall. In it, she describes her mother's elaborate garden parties in Iran with amazing meals and classical Persian musicians playing in the background. So let's set the mood and cue the tape. Donya Bijan, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
And what's the proper greeting?
Eda Shomo Mubarak.
Eda Shomo Mubarak. Pretty good.
Mubarak.
Mubarak. Mubarak better than that. Okay, thank you. Okay. So before we get to the actual food, I do want to talk a little bit about your story. Your memoir is an homage to your mom, who's passed away. I'm sorry for your loss. For people who haven't read your book, how did you find your love of cooking, and what role did your mom have to play in that?
Well, the book is so much a love letter to my mom because she nurtured that love and passion that I have for cooking from when I was a little girl. I was an awkward little girl who found grace in the kitchen. She never shooed me away, you know, didn't say, oh, go outside and play. She always gave me a task and expected me to follow through. And I think I knew from when I was very little that I wanted to be a cook, but it wasn't a profession, so to speak, that one would send their daughter to university for. But I knew that the seed was planted and that someday it would blossom. And it's America's fault, really, because it was here where I found my voice and realized that I can make my own choices and make my own life.
And you were trained. You are, in fact, a trained chef. You were trained at the Cordon Bleu, the premier French culinary school. You owned your own French bistro in California. Did your mom live to see you kind of embrace this love in this way?
She did, and she forced me to go to France. She insisted that I go to the source if I wanted to learn to do something well. And she took on a graveyard shift at the hospital where she was a nurse, so that she could pay for my tuition and send me to France. And she saw my restaurant open. She would come and bring her friends and boast about her daughter and clip all the little reviews. And she had a scrapbook. So she was very proud of me.
Do your two culinary heritages ever collide? I mean, you're classically trained in the French tradition, but you grew up with this heritage of amazing Persian cooking. Do the two ever collide, or do you keep them separate?
They collide every day and all the time because I'm constantly thinking about food. And when I'm making Persian food, I bring the French technique to that process. So it's been tremendously helpful. I've been told that I'm a little bossy also in the kitchen, which I must have picked up from my mentors and French chefs I worked with. You can't help but draw from all that information that's in your pantry. And I think very much that food is the perfect vessel to travel back and forth between those cultures.
You're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. It's the first day of spring. Happy spring and happy Nowruz. We're speaking with chef and author Donya Bijan about the Persian food she indulges in for the new year. Ah, food. Let's talk about food. The new year calls for two particular mainstays, as I understand it, herb rice and fish. And you, as the chef, are responsible for that part of the meal. Why is that? Is that the hardest thing to get right?
You know, the hardest thing about that herb rice is chopping the herbs. That because they have to be done just right, and it takes forever, so you have to be patient. And it certainly teaches you that good cooking does require a lot of patience. But yes, those are the two mainstays, that spring herb rice, which is fresh herbs like cilantro, parsley, and dill that are folded into the rice, and along with brand new shoots of garlic and leeks, and all that green represents rebirth, which is the central theme of Nowruz. And also it's served with fish, and fish represents life, which, you know, is not complicated to make the fish part, but it's the rice part that the new generation of Iranian Americans, myself being part of that, we should have paid closer attention to when our mothers and grandmothers were making that dish.
Well, I don't want to call any names here, but our producer, Sanas Mishkanpour, had quite a few words about how long it took to make this dish. It was, I believe, 3 hours, although it may have gotten longer in the retelling. But it turned out quite beautifully, I must say. And if you don't mind, Donya, I'm going to have just a teeny little bite here. There's a beautiful, its crust isn't quite right.
That's the tadig, and that's the prize of your meal. That, you know, you've worked so hard, but that is the best part. Families fight over that part.
Oh, do they really?
Dish.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yes.
This is interesting. Well, I'm fending off all comers in here. Forgive me. I'm going to have a little bite.
Nusha John.
It's delicious. Mmm. How do you, you don't live in Iran now, obviously, but people are preparing for the holiday for quite some time. How do you translate that here? Do you feel sort of sad in a way because people around you aren't as engaged with it as you would be? Does it kind of bum you out a little bit, or what do you do to kind of get the excitement level up?
You know, it's bittersweet. As far as for those of us who live in exile, I myself for too long relied on my mother to carry the tradition of Nowruz. Like I said earlier, I didn't pay close enough attention. But being that we are the sons and daughters of that generation, and it's up to us to continue to teach the rituals and the smells of Nowruz to our children, to the next generation. And I fumble through a lot of it, but, you know, there is a determination to get it right and to pass along those traditions.
Donya Bijan is a chef and an author. She is author of the memoir, Maman's Homesick Pie. To get the recipes for her spring rice and salmon dishes, go to npr.org/tellmemore. And happy spring and happy Nowruz. And once again, it is
Eid Shoma Mubarak.
Eid Shoma Mubarak.
Earlier this hour, we reported on the case of Trayvon Martin. He was the black teenager shot to death last month by George Zimmerman, a member of a neighborhood watch group. Zimmerman claims Martin was acting suspiciously and that he felt threatened. Zimmerman has faced no charges. But Martin's family and his lawyer say he was just an innocent kid who had stepped outside to grab a snack. For commentator Tayari Jones, the shooting has revived a familiar conversation about race.
Like many Americans, I have been glued to the television, eager for details about the tragic murder of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. I'm not sure what I hope to discover, because each new piece of evidence is more disturbing than the last. I listened to the recently released 911 tapes from my office computer and cried in public. I was up until after midnight scanning my Twitter feed for news and comfort, a 21st century vigil of sorts. I'm only the latest in a long line of black women speaking the names of our murdered boys. This is my role as a woman in the community, but my ties to this case stretch back to when I was a little girl growing up in Atlanta, Georgia. When I was in the fifth and sixth grade, dozens of African-American children were murdered. Almost all of them were boys. Even though Wayne Williams is believed to be the murderer, questions and scars persist. Learning about death and dying is part of growing up. If we're lucky, we come to understand that death is natural through the passing of a grandparent or some other elder. But for too many of us, we are made aware of our own mortality by seeing our peers, the boys we wanted to go to the movies with, the boys who used to pull our hair. We learned that they could be killed for the crime of being themselves, young, black, and male. When the Atlanta child murders occurred, I was just at the age when we were noticing the differences between the sexes. As the body count increased, I realized that in my community, the difference was that if you were a boy, someone might try to kill you. Recent reports have surfaced that Trayvon was on the telephone with a girl as he walked from the store where he had bought candy. The girl on the phone was the last person to speak to Trayvon Martin. I am filled with sorrow for her. When I was young, girls were not mere bystanders as we watched our mothers groom our brothers to live in a world that feared them. Boys were taught not to look police, security guards, or anyone with authority directly in the eye. They should say only, "Yes, sir," or "No, sir." We, too, were in training, learning to protect the men we loved. We became our mother's surrogates, reminding the guys to keep cool, to be quiet. We knew they wanted to impress us, but we begged them not to talk back the way boys always do. Today, at 41 years old, my girlhood is behind me, but the memories of dead boys linger. Most childhood fears are terrors that you grow out of. As you age, you realize that there is no monster under the bed. But the worry that someone will look at a black man and deem him to be suspicious and feel justified in killing him, this is a threat that only deepens as he grows older, if he's lucky enough to get older.
Tayari Jones is the author of the novel Silver Sparrow. You can comment on this essay at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Opinion.
You're listening to All Things Considered.